Thank you to Jay for such a wonderful speech, and it's just such an honour to be able to share some thoughts with you today. I'm going to be speaking on some of the politics of Kleinian technique in the post-war period. On the 1st of June 1949, the British Psychoanalytical Society gathered for an important meeting in their roster of proceedings. The occasion was the delivery of a paper for admittance of membership. Although a significant event in itself, the applicant, at a tender 27 years of age, was at that time, in fact, the youngest applicant who ever made an approach to the society. Now, as the young woman rose to give her address, it became quite clear to her audience straight away that what she had to say was perhaps going to be almost more important than her youthful attainment. In recent years, she begins, an increasing number of psychoanalysts have begun to treat schizophrenic patients using various modifications of technique. I think, therefore, that the case I describe will be of interest, since I have attempted to analyse a typical schizophrenic, with no doubt about the diagnosis, with only minor deviations from strict analytic technique. Especially, I took care not to step out of the role of the analyst who interprets into that of an ally or an educator. Having provided some background details about the patient, whom she calls Edward, she returns to what she means by strict analytic technique and some of the difficulties she encountered in implementing it. I quote, "At the beginning of the analysis, the patient was detached from reality and unable to grasp the nature of the treatment," close quote. Primarily, this was because Edward gave short shrift to reality, being distracted by more pragmatic matters, such as the extent of his liberty. She describes how Edward, he, quote, "appealed to me repeatedly to let him out of the hospital and would follow my footsteps when I was on my way out. He kept asking me to take him to the pictures or for walks to arrange a means of escape for him," close quote. Now, although Edward's preoccupation with freedom was not at all unfounded, as he had actually been immured for quite some considerable period of time, the speaker cautions us that we should realise that, in fact, he is already a prisoner of his own mind and we shouldn't be distracted by the fact that he's been relieved of his liberty. And, in fact, particularly irksome for the speaker appeared to be the fact that, quote again, "Edward was constantly demanding reassurance from me." She concludes that the only advisable stance when faced with demands such as those for reassurance is to, quote, "retain the attitude of the analyst even without the cooperation of the patient." Now, the speaker was, of course, Hannah Seagull, delivering her celebrated paper, Some Aspects of the Analysis of a Schizophrenic, a text that instantaneously became a canonical clinical statement and immediately made of Seagull a highly regarded analyst and leading proponent of Kleinianism. Now, if I've chosen to foreground this classic statement of a psychoanalytic treatment in the way that I've chosen to do so, then it is to remind us of something that I think we too easily forget. That is that whatever else we might be doing when we're engaged in clinical work with people, we are also making people up, to borrow a phrase from the Canadian philosopher of science, Ian Hacking. Clinical work and our stories about it are thoroughly social and political affairs, whose specific claims to knowledge arise within the exercise of particular relationships and strategies of power. Strategies and relationships formative of certain kinds of people. Now, I think I want to stress it would be supercilious of us if we just heard in the phrase making people up that it is only the patient that is made up. In fact, actually, patient and clinician are twins. They are born together and they emerge simultaneously from the interplay of social and historical forces that transcend and traverse them both. Seagull approaches her patient Edward as a typical schizophrenic, although she declines to tell us how she's defining schizophrenia in this paper, or indeed how she can be so confident such a classification can be reasonably placed beyond question. For Hacking, the categories of clinical medicine, he's not just thinking of psychology, but in this context, these categories like schizophrenia, they're not immobile universals. Rather, classifications are in a state of constant dynamical emergence from their relation with diverse non-clinical interests, social pressures, and historical circumstance. whilst those under the ages of classifications interact with their classifications and to their classifiers. Now, what this means is that objects of classification form moving targets. They're not pinned down, so they oblige us, in working clinically, to have to continually shift and redraw the classificatory boundaries and amend our approach in order to better fit the object that is created through the approach itself. And I just want to say that my leaning on hacking here, I'm not trying to advance a sort of social constructivist sort of or relativistic case with regards to clinical medicine and the effects of naming. Instead, I'm trying to indicate that such categories are to be handled as both real and invented. Because what I want to do with you this morning is to raise the question of what happens to our patients, as well as to our theories and clinical methods, when we neglect to attend to the constitutive force of our clinico-theoretical models. So, let's return to Siegel's paper. In it, she recounts the first 3 years of treatment with Edward, who suffered a breakdown while serving in the army in India. As a child, Edward apparently did not present with any noticeable difficulties. His personality, Siegel tells us, seemed to fit perfectly the requirements of the old-fashioned public school, something perhaps which tells us more about old-fashioned public schools than about Edward. Instead, Edward's difficulties only became apparent to those around him after he was conscripted to the army, when he found himself in the place of confinement, a photographic darkroom. Initially, it was not possible for Siegel to work with Edward in accordance with strict analytic technique. Instead, their preliminary meetings were conducted at an army sanatorium and, shortly thereafter, in a private nursing home, to which he was subsequently discharged at his family's expense. In fact, it was only during the 6th month of the treatment that what Siegel calls the formal analytic situation was established. Principally, this appears to have meant that the only problems, her word, Edward afforded her were, quote, the same as those of the analysis of a neurotic. Edward's behaviour, in other words, had now been normalised. He, I quote, lay on the couch, associated, and at least consciously expected nothing from me beyond analysis, close quote. From there, Siegel describes how she pursued an analysis that, in all its technical features, was an amplified Freudianism, eschewing the cultivation of a positive transference, foregoing the provision of solace, tirelessly interpreting any resistances and honing in on the points of maximum anxiety for Edward. Now, the point is not whether this technique was theoretically warranted, whether it's clinically advantageous or morally sound. Instead, it concerns the strategic function of Siegel's adopted technique. Because Siegel was not alone amongst the Kleinians in this program of radical conservatism that sought to extend Freud's technique with the neuroses to the psychoses. In fact, this approach constitutes a shared endeavor for the Kleinians in the years following the war. In conclusion to a 1969 summary of the then historical clinical technique with the psychoses, which bizarrely completely leaves out everything that's happening in France at the time, Siegel's colleague Herbert Rosenfeld wrote, Siegel, Bion, and Rosenfeld stressed that no change in the analyst's attitude and only minor changes in technique were necessary, and that the psychotic productions attached themselves to the transference, which could be interpreted to the patient. The development of the treatment of psychosis over the last 50 years suggests that Freud's hope that some approach to the treatment of psychosis might become possible is now justified. Now, this is kind of a strange thing to say, because I think, as most of us know, Freud's hope for a technique of working with psychosis would one day be discovered, because he regarded his own technique as unsuited to the task. Rightly or wrongly, he believed analysis to depend upon the ability of the patient to produce a transference, and in his opinion, this was not possible. The Kleinians, however, exploited an opportunity to be more Freudian than Freud by insisting classical technique was applicable to the psychoses. Now, again, just to reiterate here, my aim is not to adjudicate between Freud and the Kleinians to work out who's right and who's wrong. Instead, I'm wondering why such importance became accorded to Freud's technique with the neuroses, that it had to be transposed wholesale to the psychoses, and also what the effects of this transposition was. I don't think it's sort of sufficient here, you know, to you know, we often, as analysts, we're sort of rather content to reheat on these sort of Whiggish and hagiographical platitudes of standard psychoanalytic history, you know, the reverence accorded to Freud as the founder of psychoanalysis, the sort of dead master and totemic father whose examples his followers sought to emulate, really, in basically in order to better exalt. I mean, I think an approach to this question can only be made by considering the specific context of struggle and contestation from which Kleinianism emerged. Now, if the subject was to be treated adequately, we would need to examine Klein's development as an analyst, the history of her reception within the British Psychoanalytical Society, the culture of that society at the time, and especially how these two currents ran together in the rivalry that came to a head there between her, the indigenous British analyst, Anna Freud, and the emigre continental analyst seeking refuge in Britain from the ravages of Nazism, the dispute famously known as the controversial discussions. Now, we can't do that this morning because time is already running out, so just a few key points on this. So we do actually need to note straight away that from the beginning of Klein's career, she had an unassailable conviction in the veracity of Freud's clinical method and the abilities of this method, amplified and added to with her own metapsychological thinking, of course, but never really deviated or diminished from, to access the truth of the patient. She took Freud to the letter. Even the less theoretically flamboyant Anna, in the spirit of innovation, developed her father's technique, handling it as a guide rather than a rule book, especially in her work with children. Klein, on the other hand, gave something of the impression that she saw a direct one-to-one correspondence between Freud's words on technique and the possibility of following those words, as well as a symmetry between adult and child analysis, equating the free association of adult speech to children's play. Anna likewise accorded preeminence to psychoanalytic principles, but extended a plasticity to their application. In the Symposium on Child Analysis from 1927, Klein tells us that, quote, if we compare child analysis with the technique of adult analysis, we perceive that we assume unconditionally that a true analytic situation can be brought about only by analytic means. Secondly, but closely related, was Klein's lifelong battle to be regarded as scientific. Although initially received with warmth and curiosity by British analysts, especially Ernest Jones, who saw in her ideas an opportunity to redress a sense of British intellectual inferiority with regards to psychoanalytical work on the continent, Klein always encountered an air of disdain in certain quarters. There was, I believe, more than a touch of British class snobbery in this. Anna Freud may well not have been possessed of great intellectual educational attainment, but her consanguinity guaranteed her standing. Klein, on the other hand, was a veritable outsider, a woman of modest origins without any medical training, nor indeed any higher education at all, who found herself in a psychoanalytical society of members drawn from the loftier climes of British social and intellectual life. She did, however, was also very willful and possessed of enormous stubborn self-conviction. Throughout her career, she remained irritated but also genuinely perplexed that her position as a psychoanalyst did not afford her the same authority over patients as psychiatrists. Still, she clearly recognised her humbler background as being and lack of medical training as a hindrance to her cause, so drew around her medically qualified and intellectually distinguished colleagues such as Siegel, Bion, Rosenfeld, amongst others. Thirdly, the fracas of the controversial discussion centred in a large part around lineage. Was Kleinian psychoanalysis really psychoanalysis, or was it an heretic elaboration like the work of Jung or Adler? The Kleinians failed to definitively settle this question intellectually with the scientific papers they presented during the controversial discussions. So, under threat as a dissenting minority within the BPS, subordinate outside the clinical authority of the health services, the Kleinians faced a battle for establishment validation. Now, one possible way this could be achieved was by demonstrating the rigorous application of a method already confirmed the stamp of official approval, because Ernest Jones had succeeded in having psychoanalysis recognised by the British Medical Association in 1929. So here again, we come across some of the pressures of the British class system, which is always taking great comfort in the right way of doing things. Now, the Kleinians might have faced the tactical disadvantage in furthering their cause, by being regarded by some, if not by all, as heretical and quite possibly unscientific, but they certainly were not open to the charge of being sloppy in their practice. So I suggest that Siegel's paper of application to the BPS might therefore be regarded as a double solicitation. Not only is Siegel applying for personal ratification, but as an alisand, an ally of Klein, she is seeking to establish the legitimacy and indeed superiority of the work of her mistress over their enemies and rivals. So one way to approach Siegel's work with Edward then is as part of a broader program, a drive in the post-war years to legitimize Kleinianism as the true continuation and heir to Freudianism through the application of Freudian clinical method to the kinds of cases that has eluded Freud technically. Such a strategy enables the Kleinians to trump those who relax Freudian psychoanalysis by lapsing into the role of either an ally or an educator, characterizing them as the true heretics, lacking the fortitude to pursue a pure, exacting science of interpretation. The echo of Klein's charge against Anna as having betrayed the legacy bequeathed to her are clear. So the result of making themselves up as psychoanalysts in such a rigid sense is that the Kleinians of this period end up hoisting themselves and their patients by their own psychoanalytic petard. Both analyst and patient are co-constructed as cartoons of their respective role. Truth is on the side of the method of the clinician, illusion on the side of the patient, the clinical technique is true because the patient cannot recognize it as such, and the greater the resistance, the greater the weight of proof accorded to the method. Right. So far, I've focused on the manner in which clinical practices is embedded in a broader socio-historical milieu, a constitutive of particular clinical objects that are there rendered amenable ex post facto to theorization and classification. To conclude, I want to try and depict a little bit more precisely one of the ways in which Kleinian clinical practice provided the conditions for the creation of its own distinctive theory. In her paper on Edward, Siegel first introduces, albeit in a form waiting full of theoretical elaboration in later essays, what for many has become regarded as her greatest contribution to psychoanalytic theory. That's her model of symbol formation and her notion of the symbolic equation. Now, although this is couched in Kleinianism's sort of Gothic metapsychology, Siegel's insight here is not for the initiated alone and can be stated quite plainly. Siegel proposes that in psychosis, there is a breakdown in the ability to make use of representations, i.e. one thing can't be substituted for or stand in for another thing, instead they become fused together. Now, what Siegel is pointing to is a long attributed feature to psychosis has already come up this morning, and that's its literalness, its struggle to metaphorize. Siegel's incredibly famous example that she repeated endlessly throughout her teaching and writing is the contrast between two violinists. In 2001, she drew the distinction like this. One was an extremely gifted professional violinist whom I interviewed on the ward. When I asked him why he stopped playing the violin, he responded, "Do you expect me to masturbate in public?" At the same time, I had an analysis, a young man who played the violin for whom the violin too often represented his penis and potency, amongst other things. This in no way prevented him playing. For the first patient, the violin was felt to be the penis. For the second, it represented the penis. Now, it might seem that it is Siegel's neutral observation that leads her to formulate her specific theory of symbolism and its role in psychosis, and from there, this theoretical elaboration then informs her approach as a psychoanalyst. This, however, I believe would be to state matters the wrong way round. Instead, I would suggest that there has already been an antecedent symbolic equation at the level of Siegel's relationship to psychoanalytic theory. And that is what enables her to then construct the theory that she then goes on to do. And this symbolic equation is, as we have seen, the Kleinian failure to metaphorize or to interpret Freud's technical prescriptions on psychoanalysis, instead treating his pronouncements on technique literally as a set of rules that can possibly be followed. In one of the final lectures she gave before her death, Siegel illustrates this symbolic equation to a striking degree. She says, "One cannot overestimate the importance of the psychoanalytic setting. The most important factor of the setting for the mental phenomenon is the analyst's own frame of mind as reflected in the setting. The analytic attitude, first described by Freud, is that of suspended free-floating attention and is the basis of all settings. Now, the irony, I think, must not be lost on us here, because this narrow and unyielding method of interpretation can't even be made sense of from within Siegel's own metapsychology. Because if it is indeed the case that the psychotic patient struggles with symbolism and therefore battles with metaphorization, then it is not at all clear how a technique of interpretation could be of any use in such cases, as interpretation is predicated precisely upon the operational process of metaphorization. The Kleinian inability of this period to handle Freud's pronouncements on technique with plasticity, to subject them to the work of subject formation, therefore results in the symbolic equation of technique dovetailing in the clinic with the supposed symbolic equations of the psychotic patient. Now, if I've chosen today to raise some challenging issues in the history of Kleinianism, then it is not, when all is said and done, to speak to Kleinianism, or at least not to Kleinianism alone. Rather, it is to prompt all of us who work with psychosis to wonder about where such symbolic equations lie in our own clinical practice, as well as in the fashions we make up the people we see and how we ourselves are made up as individual clinicians. Like Siegel, who is a passionate and lifelong peace and anti-nuclear disarmament campaigner, we might consider ourselves shorn of common prejudices, broad-minded proponents of progressive values and enlightened views, who in our consulting rooms are at pain to treat our patients with dignity. Neither should it be said that this is yet another call to liberate the mad in the name of some hypothetical freedom that surely does not exist anyways. Instead, it is to remind us that, like Siegel, we are also captives of our time and place. We who have also to be prisoners in order to recognize our fellow inmates as prisoners of their own mind. All the better to bind them either with the fetters of our technique, the locked doors of our asylums, or the pharmaceuticals that roll off our prescription pads. Now, it seems impossible, having arrived at this point to you this morning, that I couldn't close today without the following passage from Michel Foucault. This is one of his most famous from The History of Madness. To the doctor, Freud transferred all the structures Pinel and Tuke, the famous moral treatment, had set up within confinement. He did deliver the patient from the existence of the asylum within which his liberators had alienated him, but he did not deliver him from what was essential in his existence. He regrouped its powers, extended them to the maximum, and united them in the doctor's hands. He created the psychoanalytical situation where, by an inspired short circuit, alienation becomes disalienating because in the doctor it becomes subject. Thank you.